more thing for what it's worth. This, we did get the fiscal inputs on Eights and Nines, in case they make it to the fair.
Let's call to order this meeting of the House Rules Committee. It is Wednesday, May 4th. Welcome. We're going to be doing a little bouncing around today. We're going to take up HCR 35 first. We're going to take up HCR 36 last. And then we're still negotiating a little bit about what we take up in what order in between. But let's begin by opening a public hearing on HCR 35. Invite Senator Pozanski and Representative Hannah Ford and Mr. Stenbridge brief us on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, this is HCR 35. It commemorates the city of Sutherland on its 100th anniversary.
Welcome to the House Rules Committee. Proceed in whatever order you prefer.
All right. Thank you, co-chairs. Floyd Przomski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. We're here with HCR 35. You're going to actually hear from what we would consider our certified smart people from the local that's going to tell you as to the perspectives as to why this is an important resolution. Basically, it notes that they have been existing as a incorporated city for 100 years as of yesterday. And if you've had a chance to look at the resolution, it really highlights some of the interesting parts of the city as it has developed. And I was going to give the committee a little history prior to Sutherland becoming a city of itself. That it came into existence after the territory, which was our 37th county of the state of Oregon, Umpqua County, had come and gone. And so it's still Sutherland's still here, even though Umpqua County is not. Umpqua County got broken into Douglas County as well as Coos County back in the during the 1800s. And the one thing I will point out to you, if you when you read through the resolution, it talks about some of the highlights there, including the Camas and from the valley and stuff. And if you have not had a chance here, and if you have not had a chance to see Camas recently, I would suggest that you go over to the Bush Pasture Park on the east side. The Camas is just in full bloom as of about 2 days ago. So with that, we hope that you will look favorable on this resolution.
Great. Thank you.
Co-chairs, thank you, colleagues, for allowing us to be here. I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative from House District 7, and all of what Senator Przomski said is true, and we're thrilled to present Sutherland in this way. It's interesting, in House District 7, Sutherland is the largest community in the district, and the district is the fifth largest in the state of Oregon, so Sutherland is literally my hub of population. It's also one of Oregon's continued natural resource-based towns. It is one of the few towns where still on Main Street is an operating wood product facility. And we're proud of that, and the Murphy Lumber Group still operating a mill there, one in which Senator Przomski was very helpful after a fire in getting that project back up and going and employing a number of folks within Sutherland. And with that, we would look hope for your favor on this resolution and look forward to its passing. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We've got several other witnesses on this resolution. Let's begin with Mayor Cameron. Actually, why don't we bring all four of you up? We'll just add Mayor Cameron, Patricia, Dwayne, and Pamela. We'll have you all four on the same panel. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Patricia Klassen. I'm the council president.
I'm Pam Cameron. I'm on the Sutherland 100 committee as well as a member of various nonprofit community programs.
Dwayne Waller, volunteer.
Great. Please proceed. Testimony.
I'd like to say first that Dwayne's a lot more than that. He's just being shy. I want to thank you for this opportunity to come before the committee in support of House Concurrent Resolution Number 35. Sutherland started planning our celebration for our centennial last year, kicking off real promotion at our Christmas Festival Parade in December. We designated the weekend of June 24th through the 26th the date of our actual celebration. There's going to be parades and games and a logging show, pistol show. I can't name them all. It's going to be a fairly full weekend. However, everything we're doing this year is having a centennial tie. We have major events that will happen in May, June, July, August, and September. In addition to our usual annual events, we added the centennial, which I just mentioned, on the last week in June. We're bringing the traveling Vietnam replica wall to Sutherland the last weekend in July. And we have been designated this year as the start and finish for Cycle Oregon, which is going to be a big deal for us. We hope for approval of Resolution 35 to underscore the value our state places on cities and the citizens who keep them alive. Sutherland is struggling for an identity. This resolution can help us promote our history and our purpose. It ties us to the state, and it ties us together as those who are present when Sutherland turned 100.
Excellent. Thank you.
I consider my role in Sutherland as the cheerleader, so I'm just going to be a cheerleader and say that we are so proud of not only our centennial committee and our volunteers that we have, that I want to invite everyone here to come down and take a look at Sutherland this summer, because we're mighty proud of it.
All right. Great. You're a good cheerleader.
11 and a half years ago when we moved to Sutherland, we had no idea how involved we'd become in the community. We learned that we have, with our population of
8,165.
We have community groups that do everything from helping with sight and hearing, having a food pantry to feed the people that are
less fortunate.
Thank you. I don't know why I can't talk. And a variety of other things, multiple churches and groups that help all of our community. We are still a group primarily of hardworking individuals. It is not a rich town, and it never has been. We're a beautiful valley with a heart of gold.
I don't know how I'm going to follow that up.
You want to pull the mic a little closer to you would be great.
Having been born and raised in Douglas County, spending the last 15 years volunteering in Sutherland, it's very important to me to be able to see this community grow. And to get all of the groups to come together in 1 year and make something like this happen is phenomenal. It's rare that you see it, and it's great to be involved.
That's great. Outstanding. Any questions? Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt. I want to thank this panel for coming up as fellow Douglas County folks. I grew up in Oakland, which is pretty close to Sutherland. I'd say it the other way. Oakland's a little bit older than Sutherland, so Sutherland's actually a part of Oakland, but depends on where you grew up, I guess. I've got family members that live in Sutherland, and my father's owned several businesses in Sutherland through the years, and very much feel a part of your community, and it is a wonderful community, and thank you for being here today.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Great. Thank you all. We appreciate you being here. Congratulations on your centennial. Anyone else would like to testify on this resolution? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on HCR 35 and open a work session on HCR 35.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I move the HCR 35 to the floor with a due adopt.
Co-Chair Olson moves HCR 35 to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Discussion. Amy, you call the roll, please.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Excuse.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Excuse.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Olson?
Affirmative, absolutely.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. And does Speaker Hannah want to carry this on the floor? Do you know? For yes, we'll say now, and if he changes his mind, we'll be happy to queue that up. So we'll put Speaker Hannah on to carry that bill. And congratulations again. And you can come back. It'll probably be on the floor within the next. Actually, if there's a particular day you would like it on the floor, you can work through Speaker Hannah's office, and we can have it on whatever day, whatever weekday you would prefer. Before June 30th. Close the work session on HCR 35. I don't care. Okay. So I see the state treasurer in the audience, so let's move to the end of our agenda and open a work session on House Bill 3452 and invite forward Treasurer Wheeler, and if you have someone else you want to bring with you, Mr. Salaggio.
Mr. Chairman, the House Bill 3452, you've heard before. I think the attention now focuses on the 8 and 9 amendments, the Dash 8, Dash 9. The Dash 8 replaces the measure to establish a three-member Oregon Economic Development Finance Authority to invest and manage state other funds accounts to create jobs, provide economic opportunity, otherwise support economic development in Oregon. The Dash 9 is the same as the Dash 8 with a slight addition that as a report would include a recommendation as to whether the authority should continue to exist beyond 2005. Mr. Chairman, we do have a impact and revenue and fiscal statements. The revenue statement was no revenue impact. The fiscal statement on the 8 and 9s was minimal fiscal impact.
Great. Representative Barnhart, is there anything you want to say in terms of the status of the bill before the Treasurer speaks to it?
I think Mr. Stembridge has covered the topic very well, and I think the committee needs to decide which of these two versions it likes better. I think it would be very useful for the committee to hear from the Treasurer.
Okay. Great. We'll do so. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler, Treasurer for the State of Oregon. With me today is Michael Salvaggio, who is the Legislative Director for the State Treasury. Over the last year, there has been a considerable amount of discussion within the legislature and those who are close to the legislature about what are the best legislative strategies that we could bring to the forefront around economic development. Most of these concerns have focused on the need for investment capital, particularly in communities around the state of Oregon, but focused more specifically on the needs of small businesses. There have been a lot of ideas that have been vetted, including the creation of a North Dakota-like state bank model, bringing that here lock, stock, and barrel to the state of Oregon, to other ideas that have been brought forward. I believe that House Bill 3452-8 meets the criteria that I set out in a memorandum that I sent to the legislature back on January 13th. In that memorandum, I described what I would support and what I would not support in terms of overall economic development strategies coming through the legislature. In that memorandum, I said that I would support any effort to coordinate and consolidate what I see as highly fragmented economic development resources dispersed throughout various agencies and various jurisdictional authorities in the state of Oregon. For example, in the Treasury, we have direct investment tools like the Oregon Growth Account, the Oregon Investment Fund. We obviously have a role to play in terms of the issuance of new debt. There are other agencies like the Departments of Agriculture, Transportation, Business Oregon, and others that have other pools of economic development resources. I said that I would support strategies that maximize the efficiency in terms of how we deploy those economic development resources. What that really means is that we would have a means of determining how to best prioritize those resources in terms of their ability to generate long-term economic activity and generate job growth in the state of Oregon. And we would set up a mechanism by which we could actually measure whether or not we are accomplishing our economic development goals. I said that any strategy that was developed would have to complement the existing network of community banks and credit unions across the state of Oregon. And very importantly, I would support anything that brought a longer-term focus, in other words, a strategic framework to our overall investment goals. I also said what I wouldn't support. I said I would not support any economic development tool that was in direct competition with our network of community banks and credit unions. I know that raised some eyebrows, but I'd like to tell you just briefly why. In many communities across the state of Oregon, particularly rural communities, banks and credit unions are often the only or certainly the major source of economic development activity and lending capacity for the community and for small businesses in those communities. I also said that I would not support strategies that put our vital public dollars at risk or put at risk the state's general fund. House Bill 3452 addresses those criteria. I called together a group of stakeholders on what I saw as being sort of both sides of this issue some time ago. That included banks, it included credit unions, it included representatives of those institutions, it included members of the Working Families Party that's diligently been advocating for a state banking model along the lines of North Dakota, it included consumer advocates, business leaders, interested legislators, and others who had a stake in this discussion. I believe that the House Bill 34-8 amendments do address many of the concerns that were raised by the people around that table. It also calls on the resulting authority advised by a council of involved citizens to recommend changes and refinements to the legislation that could be brought forward in the next legislative session. There have been a number of questions raised about this bill. First of all, do we really need it? It's true that there are a number of aspects of this bill that could be enacted by rule. But what I think this bill does that's so important is it has the ability to bring a lasting, rational economic development strategy that's insulated from the political whims of what's considered politically in vogue at any given period of time. Most importantly, we need to establish a strategy that outlasts whoever's in the driver's seat. The coordination is needed because over the years, the changing vagaries of our political dialogue, the changing environment, has led to a fragmentation of both the strategy and the actual economic development resources. Second of all, the governor has called for a 10-year process around budget planning. I think that makes a lot of sense. But it makes even better sense if you also add to that long-term expense planning process, if you will, a long-term economic development process in terms of how you're going to deploy those economic development resources. We need to coordinate our economic development resources not only across funds, but across the years as well. I've been asked, is this the first step to the creation of a North Dakota-like state bank model in the state of Oregon? I don't believe so. I've made it clear through an op-ed that I had posted in the Oregonian and through other dialogue that I've had with many of you that I don't think that model is necessary. The state of Oregon has a very different historical path from North Dakota. We have very different resources in our state that we can draw upon that suggest we need to be innovative and thoughtful about what our own best needs are. North Dakota didn't have a Federal Reserve clearinghouse, so they needed to create a check clearing mechanism. North Dakota didn't have a base of commercial lending institutions that were willing to support their farm-based economy. We do, over the course of the last 90 years, have in place a very robust network of community lending institutions, including community banks and credit unions. And at the state level, I don't think we need to create new agency resources when we already have resources in those various agencies that I described earlier. What we do need is a plan, a strategy, a long-term focus, and a means of ensuring that we're investing those resources in what are truly our top economic development priorities, and then be able to measure and demonstrate that we're actually investing in the right things. We have discussed the possibility of adding a couple of amendments to this bill. We've had conversations with some of you. Firstly, an amendment that requires representation from more than one political party on the authority. This would reflect as much as possible the party makeup of the legislature so that we don't, for example, end up with two Democrats and two members of the Progressive Party. The point of this authority isn't to be exclusionary, it's to be inclusionary. We also will request a technical amendment that clarifies that the state agency operating funds are not included in this bill's purview. This is already clarified in statute elsewhere, but we think it's important to have it specifically stated in this bill so that there would not be a perceived conflict. I believe that this compromise bill does lay a strong foundation for increasing the capacity of our lending institutions here in the state of Oregon. It improves the way we invest our economic development capital, and it involves more key stakeholders and keeps them involved in decisions about how we invest for Oregon's future. I encourage your support. I thank you for your time, and of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Did you have anything else, or are you just here as a backup, Mike? Okay, great. Questions?
He's better looking as well.
Questions for the State Treasurer or Mike? Thank you very much.
Appreciate your
testimony. Thanks for coming down to the Rules Committee. I don't know if you're intentionally sitting in the front row. If you would like to, we're in a work session, but if you'd like to speak this bill, okay. So, Representative Barnhart, do you want to tell us where we are?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo the comments made by the our good treasurer about this bill. This is something that has moved a great deal from the initial concept, and it was sort of in December, I think, when I understood that the key issue that we could deal with in a bill like this was this coordinating function and deal with what he calls the highly fragmented economic resource issue. That's the point of this bill, and I think it's done in a way that does not do violence at all to the existing policies of the legislature over the years as it set up these various economic resources. It does not change any of the sideboards which currently exist. It meets the treasurer's requirement that we not risk general funds or other funds in this process, but it also and that it does not compete with local banks and credit unions. What I think it does do is it allows the authority to go forth to negotiate with the agencies that already control these funds to determine whether or not it is possible to build a coordinating system using Oregon Business as the coordinating agency for the purpose of actually handling the investment side, with the intention that these activities be worked in conjunction with and augmenting the efforts of our banks and credit unions. One of the big problems that we have is that many of these accounts are sort of sidelines for the agencies that are responsible for them. The Oregon Investment Council has responsibility for something like $57 billion. I'm not sure the exact number, but it's in that range. The account that deals with, that's earmarked for local Oregon investments, is a tiny fraction of that amount. That the Oregon Investment Council doesn't focus in a huge way on that account shouldn't surprise anybody, because it's a small part of their responsibility, and they do an excellent job of managing the investments they do manage in a way that puts Oregon at the forefront of these kinds of investments. We have funds in the Escheat account, in the unclaimed properties account, that are being invested only in the sense that they are used to derive some interest and income for the Common School Fund. And a large number of these dollars are very unlikely to ever be claimed, and therefore they would be available for this sort of account. We have over $100 million in the Oregon Growth Account, which is part of the of the Education Stability Fund. These accounts, this account is only half committed. The account is intended to be used for venture capital, and only half of it has been even committed to venture capital firms for investment, and a smaller amount than that has actually been invested in venture capital. The department of the Oregon Business Department, Oregon Business Development Department, routinely deals with businesses that come in order to get some assistance to work on their business plans that would have the effect of growing Oregon's economy and of creating jobs in Oregon. Tim McCabe expressed a frustration to me late last year that he was unable to find the resources necessary to help a business that wanted to stay in Oregon, that needed funds to expand, to actually make that happen. These resources being managed, if it can be arranged, and this bill only sets up the possibility that it might be arranged within the sideboards that I've already mentioned. If it can be arranged, it would allow that department to have a much better chance to actually assist with Oregon economic development and job growth. Colleagues, this is a jobs bill. It's an important jobs bill, and it's a triple win for us. It's a triple win because it does not cost any additional funds. We've already got the money. It's not being properly coordinated. It's already sitting in the accounts from which it can be used. It's a win for us because it doesn't require any general fund investment. And, of course, as you know, we don't have much in the way of general funds. And it will help Oregon development, business development, and the development of jobs in Oregon. So I commend the bill to you, and I agree with the Treasurer that the Dash 8 amendment is the way we ought to go to move this bill. I presented the Dash 9 amendment, the only significant difference with which is that it requires this authority to come back to the legislature to tell us whether or not it believes that it ought to continue past 2015. I don't object to that requirement. I think it's unnecessary, but if it were the committee's pleasure to pass the Dash 9 amendment and send the bill to the floor rather than the Dash 8, that would certainly be acceptable to me. I would commend the bill to your action. Now, the Treasurer has recommended two additional amendments, one having to do with a requirement that more than one party that there are no more than two members of the authority be from the same political party. I have absolutely no problem with that. I think it's a fine idea. It reduces the possibility that anybody would can think of this as a political activity. It's not. It's intended to coordinate our funds. I can't imagine it if it's going to be successful being a politically oriented activity. But adding an additional rule to do that would be fine with me. The problem is there's no amendment available to do that today. The other amendment that would require the state agency operating funds not be included in this bill is also fine with me, although, as the Treasurer pointed out, that's already encompassed by other law. What I understand from the committee chairs is that this is the work session for this bill. I'd like the bill passed and sent to the floor. I will promise, if the bill is passed and sent to the floor, to diligently ask for these two amendments to be added in the Senate, which I see no problem to, and I think it ought to be done in order to make this bill better. If it were the decision of the co-chairs to allow an additional work session, I would certainly draft the additional amendment here. And with that, I'll leave it to the committee's pleasure about what we should do.
Any further discussion among the committee in terms of thoughts on this bill, thoughts on the amendments before us? I've seen a lot of thoughtful looks, but no hands raised. Oh, Representative Holvey, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we ought to just go ahead and go with the Dash 8 amendments and pump some life into this bill. I mean, that's my perception at this point.
Didn't sound like an emotional motion.
Representative Barnhart?
Well, I'll move the Dash 8.
So Representative Barnhart moves the Dash 8 amendments that are before us and have been before us two or three times to House Bill 3452. Again, that's the Dash 8 amendments. Discussion on the Dash 8 amendments. Is there objection to the Dash 8 amendments? Representative Freeman, Representative Olson, Representative Wingard. So the Dash 8 amendments are incorporated and functionally become the bill because these are basically the basic gut and stuff amendment. So we have the Dash 8 amendments before us. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves the the House Bill 3452 as amended by the Dash 8 amendments to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Is there discussion?
I've already had mine.
You have? Yes, sir. Is there other discussion? I would just really like to commend Representative Barnhart, and I know lots of folks around our state, lots of advocates for economic development, lots of credit unions, lots of community banks have very much stepped up and made what was a good concept in terms of the authority early on even sharper and better. And I think the Dash 8 amendments are an excellent economic development jobs tool for Oregon without setting up any new, basically using the systems we have and capturing and harnessing that and targeting it in a very effective way. So I would encourage our support. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Amy, if you would be so kind as to call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Freeman.
No.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Wingard.
No.
Co-Chair Olson.
No.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye. Motion on a 4-4 vote fails. And I would close the work session on House Bill 3452. And we have three bills that were gracefully sent over from the House Consumer Protection and Governmental Affairs Committee. And I think both of the co-chairs of that committee are here today, so we can thank them for the rest of this hearings for sending those over to us. Since one of them is up here, we're going to allow Co-Vice Chair Holby to have the gavel for these next bills.
Oh.
Take note, other policy committee chairs out there.
thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson, for this opportunity. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2062.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 2062. It clarifies the process for contracting agencies performing required cost analysis or making feasibility determination considering use of its own employees before contracting out for services in excess of $250,000. It allows the contracting agency to establish a price agreement for more than one agency or public body, provided that no agency or public body contracts for services without doing the required cost analysis or feasibility determination. It allows contracting agencies to make a feasibility determination after entering into a contract in an emergency. And it requires contracting agency to include potential contractor profit in the cost analysis. It permits the contracting agency to withhold information until after the notice of intent to award contract is issued. Requires contracting agency to disclose information upon request to public employee collective bargaining unit if procurement will affect members of the unit. It declares an emergency effective upon passage, and it becomes operative on the 91st day after the effective date.
Get the sign-up sheet. Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. I don't have a sign-up sheet, so evidently there's
asking
no...
You shall receive.
just a little background. The House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection did entertain this bill, and we discussed it going clear back to February 3rd, I believe. And this bill was brought forward by Department of Administrative Services following the implementation of a bill passed in 2009. As you've heard, there has been a work group of stakeholders working to make some changes to that bill to make it a more workable bill for the agencies involved that do this sort of analysis. And the committee discussed this bill, and there became a sticking point about the profit piece that was in the bill. There was an amendment about the consideration of the contractor's profit being included in that cost analysis, as it seemed it was a definitely a charge that was incurred by the contracting agencies. But there was some discussion about whether that was a known figure or not. And there was another bill introduced that we'll hear about shortly that deals with the same subject matter. So with that, I'd like to call up Diane Lang-Catwell. Actually, we have Representative Schaffler, who I believe participated in this work group, so I'll give him the privilege of providing us a little background.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very kind of you. Mr. Chair, members of the Rules Committee, Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48. Speaker Roblin and I participated with this work group, and we met in a basement of a state building right over here on a day like this sometimes, and so it's kind of like deja vu, but I will briefly tell you what I know about this. We passed House Bill 2867 in 2009, and my whole role in this is to make sure we're not saving money on the backs of workers. I don't think that really helps our state. That leads to a lot of other issues and demands on public services when people don't make enough money to provide for their families. There were some bugs in the system that we passed, and we needed to work it out. I remember one example was, what if a bridge falls down or some emergency? Should we hold that, repair that bridge up for a long, drawn-out analysis or whatever, and that didn't seem to make much sense to me. So that's really what I'm here to say, is I don't, when we're contracting or purchasing goods and services, I'm all for getting a good deal. I'm all for saving a buck, but not on the backs of workers. And I won't go into my prevailing wage spiel today, but I do think we should cut some more timber in Oregon. There is another bill. Some good friends and colleagues of mine are behind me supporting it, that would raise the threshold from $250,000 to $2 million. That would exclude a lot of work from this, and I really would not want to contract out those jobs underneath the $2 million level and save money solely based on lower wages and benefits for workers. So I support this bill, the threshold that's in it. That is the bulk of my testimony. There's a lot of information from the department here. You're welcome to read it. I most certainly have not. I do not intend to. There's a lot of experts that will come up here and share with you detailed information on this bill, but that is the reason for me being here today. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, but this is the last duty I have today between me and getting out into the sunshine, so I'll leave it at that.
You're not going into the sunshine.
Yes, I am. Maybe I'll be in the shade, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions of Representative Schaffler?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Vice Chair, we should consider some to keep him here a little longer.
Representative Berger.
I actually have a question. Yes. Who was in the work group that you
School districts, state agencies, Representative Roblin and I, DAS, the Department of Justice. I'm sure there is a sign-up sheet somewhere that you can...
You don't need to name. I'm just trying to... Yeah. Get the scope of who was.
It was a room full of nice the unions, public employee unions. I don't want to forget my brothers and sisters. That's why I'm here.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Representative, one more question, since it was suggested we keep you here a little longer. Do you recall a discussion, the pertinent discussion in General Government Committee was about the inclusion of a consideration of the contractor's profit.
We did discuss all that, but I can't remember what we talked about, and I didn't pay attention to your committee representative, so forgive me.
Well, did it come up? But it did come up in the work group.
It was last year. I do recall something about it, but okay. I don't remember any details. Forgive me once again. There's a lot of experts behind me that can share that with you.
Good enough. I guess we'll let you loose then.
No, I really am glad you want me to be here. It's nice to be loved, but I have to take my leave.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Diane Lancaster. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Co-Vice Chair Holby. For the record, I am Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer of the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services. Today I'm here to share with you the Department's housekeeping proposal, House Bill 2062, which is, as you have heard, the goal to assist state and local contracting agencies in implementing certain changes that were made to three of the contracting statutes by House Bill 2867 in 2009. Basically, as you have heard, these three statutes do set up standards for contracting out for services, and they require state and local government contracting agencies to analyze costs and to determine the feasibility of whether to perform services in-house or to contract out when the services are expected to exceed $250,000. I have included for you a listing of the housekeeping changes, and I'll just briefly list them. There is some detail attached for each one, and certainly I will be available for questions about this as well. First of all, though, I would point you on the back of this particular testimony, Representative Holby, if I may be so bold, Representative Berger, there is a study plan, and I believe on the back of that there is a listing of pretty much who was at the study table back in 2010 when we sat down to address the issues. It's a complicated set of requirements to do these cost and feasibility studies, as you can imagine, because contracting agencies are not businesses, and so there's a fair amount of trying to move back and forth between the two worlds in order to create something that can be comparable. One of the pieces that we struggled with and we have asked for some relief about is when agencies go together and do cooperative procurements. Who's responsible for doing that cost and feasibility study? House Bill 2062 clarifies which agency is responsible for doing the cost comparisons or feasibility studies in those situations. There's another small issue, but an important one to the ethics of my profession, and that is that we added an admonition that no public body is allowed to fragment its procurements in order to avoid such studies. Client services is an area, and I'm at the top of page 2 in my prepared testimony. Client services covers a broad array of services that are performed by the Department of Human Services and many, many state and local agencies and private nonprofit services. And this particular piece clarifies that the definition that DAF provides in rule is going to be the operating definition of what is a client service. There is then the disclosure of the studies. The original legislation needed some clarification around this. This particular bill states that once an agency decides to make a procurement, that it may withhold disclosure of the cost of feasibility studies until after the issuance of an award notice. However, the agency is to disclose to share the studies upon request to a public employee collective bargaining unit if the procurement decision would affect that unit's members. The unit is to keep the disclosed information confidential until after the agency has issued a notice of intent to award. Emergency contracts, I believe Representative Schaffler gave an example of that sort of situation. Portion of Highway 101 collapses and ODOT has to get it going. Things have to be taken care of to preserve health and safety issues. And again, this is a clarification that the study, if any needed to be done, could be postponed until the emergency was handled. finally, there was a rather legalistic piece that the groups talked about, but was ultimately added at the Legislative Council table, and this was to address a certain question around these studies being the basis for negligence claims in litigation actions. I have provided some detailed information then about each of these areas in the rest of the testimony, and I would be glad to answer any specific questions you might have about it. I would point the committee's attention then, again, Representative Holvey did make the point that there was discussion around an item relating to the definition of contractor profit. And at the end of our prepared testimony, we have actually the -2 proposed amendment, which would restore some original language and actually remove the duty of the agency to deal with certain pieces of contractor profit. So that is a -2 proposal that is attached to this. And then finally, as I said, the study plan that we put together when we sat down with folks to try to figure out what might be helpful in, again, creating some housekeeping assistance for contracting agencies. And with that, I would be glad to answer any further questions you might have of me.
Does any committee member have a question? Diana, clarification. I don't believe and Mr. Stembridge could probably confirm this, the committee actually adopted the -2 amendment. Your testimony indicates that there was a work group on the -2 amendment, and I'm not recalling that testimony earlier. Is that a work group that happened since the last committee?
Holvey, we didn't actually have a formal work group on the contractor profit thing. We heard information and concerns actually from the committee. We had some discussion at DAS, and we met with the co-chairs of the government committee and then proposed that we would offer up this amendment. And to my knowledge, sir, it has not been actually adopted. And so we are speaking to what is a proposed -2 version.
And just for committee's clarity, I was wondering if you could provide this committee an explanation that I believe was provided by Bill Nestle to your work group that was in your testimony originally as to why the change to profit was included in the original bill. Do you have that documentation?
I don't have the details of that advice that we received from Department of Justice at hand, Representative Holvey, and I certainly can produce that for the committee after. We did have Department of Justice, Mr. William Nestle, at our work group, and there was quite a bit of discussion around how do you deal with contractor costing. So, again, I don't have that particular piece with me today, but would be glad to have that provided to you immediately.
Thank you. And I Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, the -2 amendment, this is the first we've seen of it over here, and the previous committee, which you may know, did not adopt this amendment. It's still the original form of the bill.
Thank you. That's what I thought. So I was just wanted to make sure I was clarifying because I'm seeing the testimony from Diane. It was the -2062-2 amendment, which is not actually the current bill before us. But I think it's important for the committee to understand that little piece because it was our center of attention. And I'll just, if the committee would indulge me just a second, I'll read this, and I'm sure Mr. Stembridge can get this to you. But Mr. Nestle, the Assistant Attorney General, as to why profit would be included in the cost analysis, states that the short answer to your question is that the addition of the contractor's profit is intended to ensure the contracting agencies will not underestimate the cost of procuring the services from a private contractor, which would skew the cost comparison analysis in favor of contracting out by leaving the cost of paying the contractor's profit out of the equation. And that was Mr. Nestle's statement on that as to why it was in the bill. But anyway,
Thanks, sir.
I think that pretty much sums up the background for the committee of the bill that's before you. And if there's no further questions, not seeing any, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Next up, we have Tricia Smith, Melissa Unger. I should have said that. Tricia Smith and Melissa Unger. They're not the same people.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm with SEAU Local 503. And I'm going to make my testimony on House Bill 2062 quickly. I have more to say on House Bill 3488, but I just wanted to kind of give a little bit of background that during session in 2009, I helped draft the bill that 2867, which became law and is being discussed here today. And in that process, we had an extensive work group process. It feels like deja vu being back in this room from 2 years ago with all of the people who worked on that bill. And while I don't think we ever reached consensus on the bill, we did make significant concessions, I believe, as proponents of the bill, and make significant changes to make sure that this process worked and to make sure that it was a process where really our goal is to make sure that when we're making contracting decisions that we're taking the appropriate steps to make sure it's transparent, that all costs have been considered, and that it's not something that's done at the expense of middle-class Oregonians. And we did work in this interim work group, which was, I think, very, I want to thank DAS, because I think it was very well put together with a very clear goal of how do we make this process easier for contract agencies. And I think that House Bill 2062 does that and makes the process clearer and easier for contracting agencies in an effort to make sure that we hold contracting agencies accountable to the work that they do in-house and out-of-house. I think that this is an important step in that direction. So thank you, and I can answer any questions, and I will be back later for 3488.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the more than 20,000 education professionals working from Head Start through community colleges all over Oregon. And I was a member of the original study group that created House Bill 2867 and the work group which created House Bill 2062. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2062 in its original form and to urge you to not adopt the -2 amendments and to correct what I believe is a mischaracterization in the testimony from DAS about how the -2 amendments were created. They were not created by the work group that created the bill. There may have been discussions with members from that work group that created the -2 amendment, but the committee that worked to create House Bill 2062 discussed the issue of including profit as the chair read from Mr. Nestle. The reason for including it was so that we could have accurate comparisons of apples to apples, the total cost of providing a service. And our evidence that we had provided to the legislature over the years and that we are continuing to collect today indicated that employers were not getting actual cost information and making comparisons. And that was the reason for 2867. The reason for 2062 is to allow DAS as the Uber contractor for multitudes of state agencies to be able to implement the bill in a way that works for their unique circumstances. And we are very supportive of making that happen, just as we were supportive of the changes in 2867, which makes that bill workable for employers. So we like House Bill 2062 in its original form. We don't support the -2 amendment to that bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And I'm sorry, Mr. Larson is here with me from OSEA, and we're going to save him for the discussion on 3488.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? Not seeing it. Thank you very much for your testimony. Not seeing anyone else signed up. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify in 2062? Not seeing any. I will close the work session on 2062. And close the public hearing on 2062. Shocked everybody there for a minute. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3488.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3488 relates to the same provision in current Oregon statute. House Bill 3488 raises the threshold for required cost analysis of feasibility determination on contracting out for services rather than using agency employees from $250,000 to $2 million. It requires contracting agency to include the agency's indirect overhead costs in the cost analysis. It removes prohibition on proceeding with a procurement if the contractor's costs are lower solely because the contractor pays employees less than the agency does. It deletes requirement that the contracting agency prepare an appropriation request to hire or obtain resources necessary to perform services that the agency determined would be less costly to perform in-house, but lack the necessary staff and resources to do the to perform. It declares an emergency effective on passage operative on the first day following the effective date. You have the Dash 2 amendment, which adds selective provisions of House Bill 2062.
Thank you. And up first, we have Representative Mark Johnson. And I'm assuming that Representative Conger and Representative Wisnett would like to join him. Bravely so.
Well, do we have a choice?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey and committee co-chairs Olson and Hunt, and honorable committee members. I'm Gene Wisnett, House District 53 State Representative. Thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3488. Relating to public contracting. I'll be brief because I want you to hear from the numerous friends from the education community that Representative Mark Johnson has arranged for testimony on this important bill. We hope that based upon their testimony, you will pass this bill to provide our education community with a critical, which are having critically low budgets, to give them a tool to seek efficiencies for their expenses, which could result in smaller class sizes and lower tuition. Honorable colleagues, I was looking today at another important bill we're going to have come before us, Senate Bill 99. I hope the committee realizes that Senate Bill 99, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, is exempted from state public contracting laws. Let's treat the education community likewise by exempting them from public contracts below the $2 million threshold. I'd like to compliment the chair, Representative Hovey, as co-chair of the General Government Consumer Protection Committee. He was willing to allow House Bill 3488 to be considered by this committee to help our education community. I also want to thank DAS for their assistance with drafting this bill, which does include House Bill 2062 changes. The legislature and the governor have proposed austere budget education budgets. House Bill 3488 will allow our education leaders a tool to seek management efficiencies, which we're asking you to do. Please pass, have a hearing, a work session, and pass House Bill 3488. Thank you.
Chairs Hunt, Olson, and Acting Chair Holvey and committee members, thank you for having a hearing on House Bill 3488. For the record, Mark Johnson, Representative, House District 52. Colleagues, it's no secret to anyone that these are difficult times for our state agencies. Many of them are being asked to provide the same or even expanded state services in an environment of reduced budgetary support. These agencies are looking to us for help, and they're asking for the additional tools to help them to operate as efficiently as possible while maintaining a high level of service. House Bill 3488 was drafted for just such a purpose. It's a bill that responds to the request for help that many of us have heard from our constituents and from various agencies within our districts. They understand that the times are tough and budgets are tight, but they are asking for us to give them the means to operate as efficiently as possible with the resources that they have available to them. As it was originally drafted, House Bill 3488 provided two primary benefits to public agencies. One, it raised the procurement threshold from $250,000 to $2 million. Two, it restores the agency's abilities to once again contract out for services if they can demonstrate that they can save money by doing so. The Dash 2 amendments added content that is found in House Bill 2062 to respond to the concerns of certain agencies like the Department of Administrative Services. It is my belief that House Bill 3488, as amended, represents a complete package of tools that can give our public agencies the ability to tighten their budgetary belts while continuing to offer the highest level of service possible. As a current school board member, I am most enthusiastic about the potential benefits of House Bill 3488 to our local school districts across the state. In the last 4 years, state school support to our school district has increased by exactly 0.1%. In the same time span, our roll-up costs to cover the increased cost of salary and benefit commitments have increased by 3 to 4% per year. To make ends meet and to balance our budget, we are doing what districts across the state have done and are doing. We have laid off employees and we've slashed programs. House Bill 3488 would at least give our district a tool that could be used to allow us to operate more efficiently and possibly find savings that could be directed back to the classroom and back to kids. As a school board member and as a legislator, I believe that we also need to consider this factor. Approximately 70% of local school district budgets come from state school support. Don't we, as legislators, have an obligation to give local districts the tools necessary to ensure that the resources we provide them with are being spent as efficiently as possible? House Bill 3488 is about providing local control to school boards and administrators to manage their finances and budgets in a way that enables them to provide the best educational product possible for their communities. I thank you for your consideration and I thank you for your time.
Co-chairs Olson and Hunt, Co-Vice Chair and Acting Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I am Jason Conger representing House District 54, and the focus of my comments will be primarily on schools and the effect that HB 3488 could have on schools, although the effect obviously would be broader. When we passed the K-12 budget, I spoke out about the problem of costs. So we were dealing, obviously, in the budget bill with half the problem with the funding side of the equation. But there are two sides to any operation in the private sector or in the public sector, and that's income and expense. What I'm hoping is that we can turn our attention in a variety of ways to the expense side of the equation and get realistic about what we demand of schools or what we require from them. On the expense side, there are a lot of requirements, mandates, regulations, rules, statutes, laws, addendums, subparts, et cetera, that the legislature can change, but the school districts can't. And so as we pass a budget and we hand off the football to school boards and school administrators and teachers and parents and students, and we say, we've given you the funding side of the equation, now take care of the rest. The problem is they can't, because they can't change a lot of the expense side of their income statement. So it was recently reported that about 34 out of 100 Oregon kids don't graduate high school. I think there are a lot of things that we could take away from that, but ultimately the take-home message is our education system is failing our kids right now. We could argue all day about who to blame, and we could certainly talk about the natural questions that follow, which are, why is it failing, and what do we do about it? I'm going to go out on a limb and say the why is very, very complex, and the what to do about it is even more so. One thing we could do is we could try to give the flexibility to those who know the system better than we ever will, to try to manage those organizations, those school districts, in the best way that they can to save money. And one way to do that is to allow them to opt to contract out for services in a sort of common sense way. And HB 3488 does that. So I appreciate your consideration and hope you will also consider going into a work session and working this bill.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I really appreciate your commitment to the discourse and bringing the bill forward. Is there any questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you very much, and have a great afternoon.
Thanks.
Next up, I'd like to have Diane Lancaster. Pass that to Jim just so we, kind of a late message.
Yes, thank you, Representative Holvey, Co-Vice Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Olson, and, Representative Hunt, committee again. House Bill 3488-2, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, Chief Procurement Officer of the State Procurement Office at Department of Administrative Services. Excuse me. We have written our testimony today to again deal with the proposed Dash 2 amendment to 3488. What we have noted is that many of the same provisions that are in House Bill 2062 and the proposed Dash 2 amendment of that bill are included in House Bill 3488, the proposed Dash 2 version of this bill. There are two pieces that are changed. One of them is in the disclosure section of the cost of feasibility studies, and then the second is this piece of around the contractor profit that was picked up from that proposed amendment to House Bill 2062. Again, these are housekeeping items, and we would again have some of the same discussion materials that are included here for your reference that are identical to those items that were in my earlier testimony. With that, I think I'll ask if there are any questions of me.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Diane, I may have misunderstood, but it sounded like you were speaking just to the components of 3488 that are identical to 2062. Do you have a perspective on the additional elements in 3488?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hunt, no. DAS is okay. Not at this time taking any position on those policy questions.
Thanks.
Other questions? Ms. Lancaster, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And Jim, how are we doing on telecommunications?
We're going to call Mr. Rexford in Bend.
And along with that, I'd like to have Nick Hogan, Lori Satenspiel, and Russ Allen.
Yes, this is Jim Stembridge at the Capitol in Salem calling for Mr. Rexford.
I believe he is actually on a conference call.
That's what we're calling about. Yes, we're hoping that it'll
Just a second.
Conference call. All right.
Love technology.
As soon as we get him on, we'll go ahead and start.
Hello.
Yes, this is Mr. Rexford.
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Jim Stembridge. We're here in room 50 at the Capitol with the House Committee on Rules, and I'm going to let you talk with the Chair, Mr. Holvey.
Very good.
Well, good afternoon, and I hope you're having a good day over there. And we are discussing House Bill 3488, which I believe you're familiar with, and have some prepared testimony, so I think we will go ahead and have your testimony now if that's acceptable to you.
Very good.
If you would identify yourself for the record, please, though.
Acting Chair Holvey, Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson, committee members. My name is John Rexford. I currently serve as Deputy Superintendent of Bend La Pine Schools. One of the messages I've heard consistently through my 25 years in the school business is that we ought to run schools like a business. Having worked in the private sector prior to my career in schools, I appreciate that notion. As Representative Conger mentioned, this is a time of severely restricted resources, and we've taken our task to work both sides of the income statement, and one of the most important is driving down our cost of doing business. Whether that's seeking ways to reduce the cost of PERS, pursuing reform of OEB, or creating more flexibility in procurement practices, we are continually looking for ways to drive more resources directly into the classroom to benefit our students. House Bill 3488 modifies portions of state statute which contain seemingly arbitrary constraints to optimal school business operations. House Bill 3488 would raise the threshold for requiring cost analysis from $250,000 to $2 million. We believe that eliminates unnecessary agency work for smaller contracts, and I'm fairly confident that any cost-benefit analysis of that extra work would prove not to be cost-effective. In addition, many of our school districts are quite small and will simply lack the staff or the staff time necessary to conduct this analysis. 3488 would also remove the prohibition of proceeding with the procurement if contractors' costs are lower solely because the contractor pays employees less. This change will allow market forces to determine the outcome of procurement processes. We are in a service business, and our number one resource and cost driver is our workforce. It's important to include the efficiency of the marketplace in these processes. We really view 3488 as a way to add to our budgetary toolkit as we work on fixing our current and future budget challenges. Adding these tools does not mean that we'll be rushing out to change how we do business. It will just simply allow us to make careful and thoughtful review of our business practices on an ongoing basis as we seek to deliver a quality education to students and families. We thank you for your consideration and passage of 3488. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We're going to move on with other testimony. I'm going to ask Mr. Stembridge to start looking at time, and we may have to limit your time to probably 2 minutes, I would guess, at this point. So if you could make your testimony sort of concise and try not to hit points other people would may be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Boards, co-chairs, members of the committee. I will be brief because I would rather have you hear from district folks. Beaverton School District has also sent a letter in. I was going to read it, but I'll let you guys read that. A lot of the points that have been made, I agree with. We're supportive of 3488 and supportive of the Dash 2 amendments, which incorporates the 2062. I was a part of that work group as well, Mr. Chair. I think one of the problems that districts have is they're spending a lot of legal resources on trying to implement this bill, especially for the smaller districts. We get calls all the time about this particular bill and if they want to look at contracting out. And it's unfortunate that those resources have to be expended on just to try to manage this particular legislation. Local control is important. There's an example of a district who decided they could contract out based on the benefit analysis and the feasibility study. The information was taken to the board. The board decided with local input that it was in the best input or the best for the community that they not contract and keep it in-house. So that has been done and it's a local decision. So we would hope that you would honor that local control. And with that, I'll turn it over to Russ Allen from Albany.
Thank you, Acting Chair Holvey. My name is Russ Allen. I'm the Director of Business and Operations for the Greater Albany Public School District. During the last legislative session, public procurement of services was altered in two fundamental ways. First, a cost study is now required before a service can be turned over to a private contractor, presumably to address a concern that elected local officials could or would cost themselves more money through outside contracting. Assuming the intent of the law was to ensure the efficient expenditure of scarce public dollars, then the second significant change is indeed curious. I say that because even if the cost study demonstrates significant savings, the elected local officials are now barred from generating those savings if the reason for the savings comes from labor costs. The paradox of this last change is compounded by the fiscal crisis faced by all levels of government. I speak for many in expressing appreciation to this body for having to make difficult decisions in difficult times. Everyone is being required to do more with less. As a school business official, I can attest that projected levels of funding will have a profound impact on school boards' abilities to meet their core mission of educating students. Next school year, there will undoubtedly be fewer adults in and out of classroom, fewer materials, fewer school days, and overall, fewer opportunities for students. Any operation required to downsize ought to first look outside their core mission for potential cost savings. In education, this usually means looking for reductions outside of the classroom. Regardless of the downsizing entity, this could include looking at whether or not there are other organizations that can provide certain support services at a reduced cost. At a time when the legislature is itself dealing with significant funding constraints, it would seem that the legislature would be maximizing the abilities of boards, commissions, and councils to reduce costs with the least impact on their core mission. In the case of education, I am not suggesting that contracting with another entity to mow lawns, drive buses, or serve food is a one-size-fits-all solution. What makes sense for one community might not make sense for another. However, with regards to the sole reason constraint, to effectively close that door to all school boards who are charged with meeting the needs of their organization in their community seems counter to projecting what should be a common goal of doing what's best for kids. Thank you.
Thank you for wrapping up at 2 minutes. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. Mr. Holvey, co-vice chair and co-chairs, members of the Rules Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I am Nick Hogan. I'm the finance director from Hood River County School District, and I'll take 1 minute. Hood River County School District is the largest employer in Hood River County. We employ about 550 people, providing an awesome education to 4,000 kids. We do not currently contract out our major services. Usually schools look at food service, transportation, and custodial. We do all those in-house, but I believe we need to have the latitude to look at those should we need to with declining revenues. A real-life example, right recently I've been approached by a groundskeeping company. Our custodians maintain our grounds. We have 9 schools, just over 100 acres. A local company said that they would like to work with us and bid maintaining our fields. Under current law, I can't allow them to bid this job because I would only save money from salaries and benefits. I would like to at least let them bid this job. Any money we save on support services, we put back in the classroom. So please consider passing HB 3488. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to have Dana Hepper come up as well. I know she's on a... She's on a little time schedule, so I wanted to make sure she got a chance to speak, and then we'll open up some questions, so don't run off.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the advocacy director for Stand for Children, and we also wanted to express support for, taking another look at this, the legislation we passed in 2009. And with the goal of getting as many dollars as possible into the classroom, you all are going to see Stand for Children members and staff advocating heartily for drawing more dollars from the Education Stability Fund for closing tax loopholes so we can get more dollars to schools, for prioritizing public schools when we write our budgets. We know we need more dollars in the classroom, and at the same time, I think in times of limited budgets, we want to make sure we have as much flexibility as possible to spend the limited dollars we do have and target them toward what's going to make the most difference for children and help make sure they're they're learning. That's all.
Thank you. Committee members, questions for this first group of four?
Also, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rexford, I believe, is still on the phone if there are questions for Mr. Rexford.
Group of five. I'm not seeing any right now. I think the committee's content in listening to the testimony since we have a lot of it and trying to soak all this in. Thank you so much for testifying on this bill.
Mr. Rexford, do you want to continue listening in, or shall we hang up?
We'll go ahead and hang up. I'll listen over video.
Thank you very much.
So next up, let's... go ahead and bring up Jim Green, Chuck Bennett, Karen Smith, and Eileen Miller. Since that's four, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I'm very pleased to note that with all the effort we put on putting our committee sessions on the internet, we know we have at least one person watching us today.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Smith, and I represent the Oregon Community College Association, which represents all 17 Oregon community colleges and more than 385,000 students statewide. OCCA is here today in support of House Bill 3488, because it will give the colleges greater flexibility in this very fiscally challenging time. Elected community college boards are accountable to the public in ensuring that the public funds are spent wisely. This includes both the state appropriation as well as local property taxes that are raised at the local level. This requires them to be able to look at all options related to contracting for goods and services. The existing cost analysis requirement that was passed in the public contracting law last session has had a chilling effect on their ability to do this. This is especially true for the small rural colleges like Columbia Gorge Community College that simply do not have the staff to even go through the process of determining whether or not they have to do a cost analysis, much less actually conduct a cost analysis. Dr. Frank Toda with Columbia Gorge Community College wanted me to share with you his concerns that this has taken viable options off the table and he is not able to put resources back into students and instruction as a result because he can't even look at the ability to contract out some services and achieve cost savings. I'd like to turn it over to Eileen Miller, who is the procurement specialist at Chemeketa Community College, to provide the college-level analysis.
Thank you, Karen. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Miller, and I am the procurement services supervisor for Chemeketa Community College. I have 29 years' experience in public contracting, all at the community college level. And I am here to express my support in favor of House Bill 3488, which clarifies and mitigates some of the effects of House Bill 2867 from last legislative session. I did participate on the work group that was DAS facilitated in support of changes that would help modify some of the effects of the last 2867. One of the perspectives I wanted to give you was from the trenches. Instead of touching on some of the areas that have already been addressed, what I want to show you from a purchasing perspective is this is the 1990 version of the Attorney General's model rules at the time that it was implemented. I was at the community college and had been there several years already, 111 pages. The 2010 version of the Attorney General's model rules that public contracting officials must deal with on a day-to-day basis is 638 pages. Chemeketa is unusual in that it's one of the three largest community colleges within the state, and as such, we have three FTE dedicated to public contracting. That is not the case with the majority of the other community colleges. They may have two, one, or even zero dedicated to public contracting, yet they're still held to the same standard. That is a great concern to me, and what is also of concern is that House Bill 2867, it assumed opposition that in the case of Chemeketa, we actually have within our bargaining agreement a provision that ensures a conversation occurs in the event the college elects or contemplates contracting out for services. It's been my experience that as of to date, we have not had any great concerns expressed with the college contracting out for those services. And so I will keep my points brief. I think I've covered what is generally new from a purchasing perspective, and I would strongly urge you to consider adopting House Bill 3488. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs. Vice Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Jim Green here today representing the Oregon Small Schools Association in support of House Bill 3488. I think Mr. Rexford laid out a pretty good argument why in our small school districts across the state, we don't have the staff to do the type of analysis that's required under 2867 that was passed last session. And by raising that limit from $250,000 to $2 million, you'll take some of those small school districts out of the requirement that they just can't meet with the staffing that they have. In school districts, you're going to contract out, if you are, basically three services: transportation, food service, custodial, and groundskeeping. And in this environment, you've given us an appropriation to the state school fund of $5.7 billion, which for every school district across the state that I've spoken with is a reduction in funding for them. And they're looking at ways to save money, to get programs into the classroom for boys and girls. And by passing 2867 last session, you took one of those tools away from school districts. And we believe that by raising it, you'll give some small school districts the ability to not have to do that cost-benefit analysis. If you look on page one of the printed bill, beginning on lines 18 through 25, you created exemptions last session. You created exemptions for small cities. You created exemptions for small community colleges. You created exemptions for the Port of Portland, special districts, and other folks. But who you left out of there was small school districts. There was some reason you picked out the small community colleges and small cities, but the small school districts were left out. And we believe that the language in 3488 puts us back in. Now, you may say, well, what about some of those real small school districts, Jim? Do they really contract out $250,000 worth of service? Probably not. But there are some that do meet that threshold. With the rising cost of fuel in our transportation services, they'll go over that pretty easily. So this raising of the $250,000 to $2 million would give them that exemption. They don't have the staff nor the expertise, and we would support House Bill 3488.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I think you've heard a whole variety of reasons in support of the bill and the changes proposed. Just to add to it, 80% of the costs across the state for school districts is personnel. In Salem-Keizer, it's 87% of their costs. To remove this tool from the table, forestalls the question of how many folks are we going to lay off rather than how many are we going to contract out. I'm always taken with the discussion of this is all about jobs and family wage jobs. You've made a decision regarding family wage jobs at this point or the jobs at school districts when the determination was made to cut schools from their roll-up of 6.7 down $1 billion to 5.7. But not to give us back the one of the tools we can use to try to mitigate this and get funds back into the classroom is unfathomable. So we're very hopeful you'll move to work session on this. We know it is not an easy vote for many of you, but it is one that is necessary if you expect us to keep classroom teachers in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Berger.
Yes. On page two of Ms. Miller's testimony, I don't think it was mentioned, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the interesting flow chart that was presented and all the decision trees. I think it is quite revealing, and I would also like to say that I was on the committee that heard this bill last session, and a lot of these issues were raised, and we were told that this might be a huge fiscal problem for smaller districts, and I guess I'm hearing it again in real time now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chuck, first of all, that was just the first school budget we're passing this session. Stay tuned. Just didn't want to make sure you're aware of that.
Yes, sir.
Eileen, thanks for your testimony. And I appreciated the illustration because I think all of us would agree that a book of that size related to procurement is just ridiculous. Did you say the difference was 2001 was the first one? What was the year of the first one?
1990 and 2010.
Okay.
The actual published version of the first model rules that came out was 1984. I didn't have a working copy of that.
So if I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I just wanted to clarify that you're saying perhaps some of the additions to that were related to the bill passed in 2009, but I assume it's just a series of rules added on probably every biennium over the last 20 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I actually went through the document and identified approximately 9 pages that provide additional narrative reference to statutory changes and commentary from the AG that pertain just to House Bill 2867 are in this version. So 9 pages from 2867, and yes, it's a culmination through the years that continues to grow.
If I could have one more shot, Mr. Chair.
You betcha.
I'm curious, because there was this work group through the interim that I think came up with 2062. Has that work group looked at not just this one bill from this one new set of new requirements from 2009, but is there any group that's really pulled together and dug into the entirety of that book? And because it seems like there's got to be a huge amount of agreement on major chunks of that 600 pages or whatever it was you said that could be significantly eliminated or streamlined that would not be, that there would not be opposition to. But maybe I'm assuming too much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, to my knowledge, there has not been a work group that has looked at the entirety and tried to make sense of a way to simplify. But it certainly, as the statutes change, and with each legislative session, the Attorney General does go back and is required to undertake a review and update the rules accordingly.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I always look at these things and say, where could we get help in this? And one of the places we might consider is the Oregon Law Commission and have them do a thorough and keep interim review of our contracting statutes and streamlining them for all of us. So I would just present that as maybe an option within this arena that clearly is complex.
Thank you. And Representative Barnhart,
well,
you have...
I was simply going to second that suggestion from the good representative from Salem. We've had, in the Revenue Committee, we've had very, very good luck working on some very complex issues that that the Oregon Laws Commission has managed for us very effectively, very efficiently, low cost, and with great results. I appreciate the suggestion, and I think it's something that we ought to consider.
Thank you. And just a note that before I entered this building as a legislator, which seems centuries ago, but it really was not. It's only 7 years ago. There was a very extensive work group and stakeholders group that rewrote all of the public contracting laws that we currently have, and I believe it was around 2001 or 2002 in that time frame, and where they ended up separating out the public contracting to 279A, 279B, and 279C to address the different facets of public contracting, which I'm guessing resulted in the thickness of that book because it's divided up into three distinct pieces. So you actually have three books instead of one. And they did that for some very good reasons, as I recall, but it still is a lengthy piece of legislation. Having said that, I also will note my co-chair is not in the room anymore, but we did discuss public contracting in our committee and have one bill that is potentially going to look at public contracting in the interim, perhaps. I appreciate that. And one question, I guess you did mention that you were on the stakeholder group on 2062 as well, and I was just sort of curious, do you see that bill as helpful at all, or you didn't sign up to testify on that, but you did mention it in this hearing as well?
Mr. Chair, I did not sign up to speak on behalf of House Bill 2062, not because I am not in favor, but because of the additional change in House Bill 3488, which has the $250,000 threshold being increased to $2 million, so that it better addresses the lack of resources, especially at the local contracting agency level, community colleges, even though one community college falls within that purview where they are not required to conduct a cost analysis. The other 16 are subject to the cost analysis requirement.
Thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Co-Vice Chair, Chair Holdy. I want to be clear on what I heard. I'm going to ask this in a way that I want a yes or no, so let's not spend a bunch of time. Am I hearing you ask for relief and help with this now, or am I hearing you ask for a work group to work on it for sometime into the future and come back to us?
Now.
Thank you.
Bam.
Nash.
Thank you very much. Not seeing any other questions. I appreciate you coming forward with your testimony. I'm sure the whole committee appreciates it. And next up, we have Tricia Smith, Brad Larson, Bob Baldwin. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson. My name is Bob Baldwin. I am testifying on my own behalf. As a matter of employment, I am employed by Lane Community College. I'm the college's purchasing coordinator. I've been a purchasing professional for 14 years, entirely within the community college system. And in the time that I have been at Lane, the college's purchasing department has been cut from 4.5 FTE to 1. You are receiving testimony from the entire purchasing department of Lane Community College here, and we are unanimous in our opinion. If there were a bill here that would reduce my workload or allow me to do more value-added work for the college, I would be wholeheartedly in support of it. It's not this bill. In the 2 years that we've had since the bill was originally adopted in the last session, 2867, I have not had one single procurement, not one, that actually required the cost analysis. I use the same documents that my colleague from Temecula College uses. There's a form letter here. I check a couple of boxes. I drop it in the file. That's because if you look at the flow chart, we have so many exclusions and so many exceptions to the requirements for a cost analysis that all I do is mark which exception applies and I move forward. I wholeheartedly supported the original bill. I opposed the amendment. If I felt that the college were contracting out work where the cost analysis was warranted, I would be the first to advocate within the college for doing that analysis. But we don't have them. Largely because we have very few contracts that go over $250,000 to begin with. And secondly, because the ones that we do have, outside auditors, outside legal counsel, architects, engineers, related construction services, so on and so forth, are all obviously and immediately excluded from the provisions of this bill. Its workload impact on me has not been minimal. It has been non-existent. It has not even begun to impact a single procurement in the college for the 2 years of its existence. I cannot begin to imagine what it is that is causing local school districts, K-12 or community colleges, to feel that they're being overburdened by this. They can't have a smaller purchasing department than we do because I'm it. So if I can accomplish it in a matter of 30 seconds to a minute per procurement contract, I would imagine that they can as well. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we are here today in opposition to House Bill 3488 and the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3488. We have provided for you more information today than you're ever going to want on this topic, but we wanted to give you a smattering of some of the information that we are helping school districts work through as they are thinking about contracting out services that our members perform. In the booklet, I want to point out a couple of things. Inside the front cover are two documents which we commissioned from the Labor and Education Resource Center at the University of Oregon in 2004 and then a follow-up study in 2008. To look at contracting out services performed by school district employees to determine whether or not those contracts actually save districts money. We had watched districts all over the state whenever our revenue was tight, which is always, contract out services because contractors convinced school district financial folks that those contracts would save them money that they could then spend elsewhere. So we paid for studies conducted by the University of Oregon, and we've given you copies of both of them. They went and looked at actual school districts and the costs that they had incurred when they contracted out services performed generally by our members, custodial, food service, and transportation. And when you look at those reports, you will find that school districts did not receive savings as had been promised, and often were paying more for the same, for less service than they were providing to their students prior to contracting. They also found that districts had very little freedom to make a different decision once that contract had been executed, because if it was transportation, their fleets disappeared, because part of the savings was when they sold their buses. They sold their buses, they spent the money, that money was gone, and then they were stuck with a contractor. Our study of contract costs have indicated that there isn't a single cost that a contractor will give to a school district, every school district. The costs are not the same. Costs are all over the place. Whether it's one contractor doing many school districts, those costs are not the same district to district, or if they are in-house. And that's in part because each school district has a different set of circumstances in transportation, particularly with where the kids live and the geography and topography of their district and things like that, but also because they often don't get information from contractors prior to contracting or even after they've contracted with which they can know for sure what their costs will be. In transportation, we have found contracts are let on a per mile basis, which doesn't have a top end. Districts don't know what's included in those costs, and once they've contracted, they're just stuck with it. In the book, you will find, I brought Brad Larson here, who is our financial research specialist, and he can talk to you about some of the things you'll see in this book. He has done research on a number of districts in their costs, looking at transportation predominantly so that we could compare apples to apples, and also because that seems to be the place that districts are looking to contract these days. And by the way, we absolutely agree with our friends from COSA and School and Oregon School Boards Association, who remind you that we don't have enough money to operate our schools appropriately. We disagree that that reducing the wages and benefits of those providing services to students is a good long-term solution to the fiscal crisis that we are in right now.
Thank you, and if I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Please. I'm wrapping right now, sir. In the back of the first tab of your book are a couple of things I'd like to point out to you. They are recent cost-benefit analyses conducted by Central Point School District and Cascade School District for student transportation. They were prepared as an effort to comply with 2867, but I think when you read them and you realize that they are identical in their wording and that they do not compare real costs but instead assert costs based on no information, that they are not complying with the law. The point of 2867 was to insist that public agencies contract with full knowledge of what they're doing prior to contracting. And a cost analysis like this doesn't do it. We hope that you don't give them more freedom to contract in ways that they can't come back from. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes. Brad Larson, Budget and Research Specialist for Oregon School Employees Association. And I'm going to kind of, I'll be more brief a little bit, or try to be. But I probably won't be.
Two minutes.
Okay. Dr. Fernando Gappasin and I have been working on this document here over the last few months in conjunction with Reynolds School District, because they were looking at creating greater efficiencies. And I have to piggyback on what was said earlier. I don't remember which testimony it was, but the idea of this being based off of efficiencies. And efficiencies is very difficult to determine when you're looking at costs and benefits. What you'll find at the back here, if you want to trip through here, is our initial findings of the data. And these are all districts, two different comparisons. It'll be explained in the report itself. But there's a district, 10 districts in Southern Oregon, 5 contracted, 5 in-house. And there's also a secondary comparison of the Tri-County area, what I call Tri-County area, including Hood River, Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas counties, and all of those districts, 26 districts in all, 14 in-house, 12 contracted out. And what you'll see is these dark lines are the costs per rider or costs per mile of these districts in rank order, highest cost to lowest cost, going from year to year. And what you'll see is that they're all over the board. There is no necessary efficiency or so-called efficiency with contracting out. And what you also find is that cost per rider, for example, because this is what we were focusing on in transportation, cost per rider are actually higher on an average rank order for these districts in contracted districts rather than in-house districts. Yet if you look at per miles, because these are the predominant two methods to determine when you're looking at data from ODE, Oregon Department of Education, the cost per mile is actually cheaper with contracted districts. And as Tricia was saying, is that contractors like to set up their RFPs based on a per mile rate. So obviously with riders, that's actually the greater comparison here, because on a per mile rate, you can increase your miles, increase your costs, and should look like you're cheaper on a per mile basis. But the main issue here is that they're all over the board, and that's why we decided we were taking on this research is to try to find district level variables, because it's not necessarily ownership versus efficiencies. It's district level issues, and if you work through this, you'll find that there's a number of issues with contracting. One is if you look at the middle of the document here, in the middle of the book.
And I'm sorry if you could wrap up. We're running out of time pretty quickly. We've got some more people. But
essentially,
we can look at the book for sure.
Okay. But essentially, there is a number of things that right now districts are not necessarily considering. They're looking at the one-year aspect of this, trying to get through the 1 year, because the economy is down, and this is a way to save costs potentially in the 1 year, because contractors come in underbid, and you get a savings in the first year, or you sell your assets. And that's what we have seen with Central Point, for example. They had a year, and you'll find this in a document in your book, they averaged about 0 to 3 bus replacements per year from 1999 through 2009, and all of a sudden they've got to replace 27 buses next year, and that's part of their cost analysis. What we're seeing is that these districts are lumping all of the costs to the same and then adding in other areas just to kind of get around it. So essentially, there's no real issue with the cost analysis itself. Every district has line item budgets. Every budget itself, it's over $250,000, is going to have a set of salary benefits, supplies, and et cetera that will be easy to compare. They just need to get the actual data from the contractors, and that's what we're asking for here.
Thank you. I appreciate questions.
Co-Chair Hovey, I just have a couple really quick ones, if I could.
Representative Olson.
Thank you. Can you describe to me, I have always operated on the principle of what is the best fit for a school district. I think this bill supports what's the best fit, but the current conditions that we're under does not. How do you get around that?
Well, what I would have to say is that by taking out the what I'm hearing is, and I'm not, I haven't fully reviewed the bills, but by taking out the profit aspect of it, districts spend 70% or so, 75% on salary and benefits for their employees. Now, contractors, obviously, they deflate those costs and salary and benefits. But what we have found is that they make up that cost in profit. And when you look at these comparable costs on a per mile and a per rider basis, the costs are basically the same. We're looking at finding ways for districts to become more efficient in-house because they can do it. It's not saying that contractors, if you're saying that contractors are going to be more efficient and cheaper, you'd expect all of these contractors to be the cheapest per rider, and they're not. So that's sort of, a long answer to the short question, I guess. But.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, the main thrust of 2867 was brought about because we saw that districts were not understanding what the true costs of contracting would be. They were getting bids based on a per-mile basis, and all of their current information about their own costs is not based on per-mile. They don't have the ability to compare those costs and know whether or not the contract is a good deal, not just in that 1 year, but in the long term. Because these contracts, once let, as I said, whether it's transportation or food service, the equipment is gone. It's very, very difficult to bring it back. And
one follow-up. Well, Tricia, what do you do with the school districts that actually themselves feel that they could use the dollars wiser and to be able to save money? What do you do with those?
If their cost-benefit analysis shows that, with the exception of the savings coming from reduced wages and benefits for the employees providing the service, they are able to contract under the law. There's nothing to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, will they know that before they contract or after they contract? 2867 and the law as it is now insisted that they know that prior to contracting rather than waiting to find out afterwards.
I see that as just a major hurdle. That's just caused a serious problem for us, for school districts. So.
Well, we see it as due diligence and good business practice.
Well, that's your I have a different opinion. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Winger, quick question, or maybe not.
I don't know how quick, but rather than arguing about how to judge two different proposals, it seems to me that there is a more elegant, perhaps not palatable, solution. And the mayor of Indianapolis did this in the 90s and wrote a kind of well-known book about it. He didn't replace the union employees who were providing different services like garbage collection or running the water treatment plant. He simply put out for bid the effort to do the service and let the union participate in the bidding process. And in some cases, the union lost and they were replaced by private contractors. And in a couple of cases, the union outbid everyone else and they got the contract. And it seems to me that that's the win-win scenario. It allows you to prove that you are the better provider at the price point that, you know, people are looking for, and maintain, you know, the unionization aspect of it as long as the taxpayers are getting, you know, they're getting essentially a performance contract at that point, because whether it's the union or the private contractor, you're working on a contract that can be renewed, and people understand what the standards for delivery of the service are, and they can evaluate on a 3 or 5 year basis, whatever it is, whether or not they want to continue with that provider or go with another.
Thank you. Other comments? I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. I have two people left, and hopefully Representative Fredericks doesn't run out of time. So, Melissa Unger and I lost the last one. Who else? Oh, there she is. Thank you. You must have signed up on a different piece of paper. Thank you. You had to identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, Chair Holvey, thanks for letting me testify again today. My name is Melissa Unger, and I'm with SEAU Local 503, and we represent about 20,000 state workers and actually bring, I think, a slightly different perspective to this bill on 3488, and I was a key part of the passage of 2867 last session. I passed out a variety of different materials, and I want to kind of quickly walk through them. You know, first I want to kind of talk. We released a report called Moving Oregon Forward, A Better Way, that looked at contracting in that report, and we really kind of focused on two different contracts, IT contracts and nursing contracts. And in that, we found that nursing contracts on average cost 20% more to contract out, and that IT contracts cost on average 68.9% more to contract out. And that both of these services are often contracted because of a lack of available staff to fill the needs of the agencies. And we, you know, the other thing to, that we noted is that a lot of the money that went to those contractors went out of state. For IT contracts, actually, only 11% of the money spent on IT contracts went to companies in Oregon, which we thought was kind of shocking. And while we understand that contracting is going to happen to meet demand, in our report we really focused on the need to set up a process at agencies to evaluate these decisions. And that's really what we believe this bill is all about, is a process to evaluate contracting decisions. And that we think that by actually doing cost analysis, we'll find that you could save money and that you could keep money in-house, and that really this is a step, right? It's a feasibility step, a feasibility process and a cost analysis. And that most of these contracts that we studied are under $2 million, a majority of them. But they add up. And one instance is even under the $250,000 limit. It was a contract that cost $40,000, $40,048, to do the work in-house, and this is the agency's own analysis, but it cost $114,000 to contract it out, but we did because of a lack of available staff and because, you know, we didn't really go through the appropriate steps to make sure that we're actually filling that need and having it in-house. The other thing I just want to highlight is, you know, I passed out an article that was in the Oregonian today about a contract at the Department of Administrative Services that has now been canceled, but it was flagged by one of our DAS workers during their testimony, actually, and it was a contract for $330,000 for a biennium, and the contract was given to a former employee. The contractor was paid $80 an hour at the beginning of their contract and $90 4 years later an hour. And upon examination of her work, I looked at her work documents, and we did some analysis of this contract when we were writing our report. She did nothing more than what a leasing manager would do. And it's really unfortunate that this contract cost us $440,000 over 4 years before it was actually stopped. But one of the things that this goes back to is that's once again a contract that would be under this $2 million limit that we think if they did a feasibility study and cost analysis at the beginning of their process, they may have decided, oh, this is not a necessary contract. And that's a really big piece of this, is how are we making decisions about when to contract and when not to contract? And then just, I'm going to lastly end, this is a different flowchart that we made when the bill passed last time, and so it hasn't been updated significantly, but it really does show that there's lots of ways around a feasibility, like when you do a feasibility study, you really do determine, can you provide this work in-house? If you can't, then you can proceed to contract. Only if at the point that you can provide the work in-house do you actually do a cost analysis. And when you do a cost analysis, there's lots of different options about where that ends. And that really it is to say, how do we make sure that we're providing this service in an accountable, transparent, best way, whether it's contracted or in-house, and not on the backs of middle-class Oregonians. So that is, that's why we oppose House Bill 3488, and we really do think that this is a broader conversation that we hope to have about contracting and how we can make sure we're being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. Thank you for your time, and I'm free to answer any questions.
Thank you. If we could go ahead and have your testimony, too, please. You'd identify yourself for the record.
Ilana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I was not involved in the work group that led to the creation of the original bill. My predecessor was. And I know that the groups who worked together on that bill were addressing many of the issues that were brought up today from both sides. We understand that in tough economic times, school districts, agencies, other groups do feel a need to look at whether or not there are more affordable ways to do business. And creating standards for how we look at what is more affordable and what isn't is important. I believe that this bill doesn't help do that, but in fact would undermine the process that we developed to help make those decisions. A lot has been said already. I don't want to repeat it, but I do want to make sure you all know that this is a broader issue than just what you're hearing today. I have had many of our member unions from other sectors of the economy express concern to me. Unfortunately, they were not able to be here today, but our representatives from the building trades unions would have liked to be here to testify against this. They have a lot of concerns about the bill. And we also worry about what we're doing to our economy in the long run if we're looking at wages and saving money by lowering wages. That's a very important piece of the original bill for the AFL-CIO, and it's very concerning to us that that's being taken out with 3488. We oppose this bill. We hope you don't bring it to a work session, and if it is brought to a work session, we hope that you oppose it.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Not seeing any questions popping up. Thank you very much. That's the last of the people signed up for the public hearing. Not seeing any others, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3488 and open a public hearing on
2958.
House Bill 2958. Could have a very patient Representative Fredericks who...
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2958 requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS, to compile and submit a report annually to the Legislative Assembly regarding funds dispersed or distributed in Oregon under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Co-Chairs Olson is gone. Co-Chairs Hunt and the rest of the committee. And are you acting co-chair now? Is that the idea? I'm not sure. Anyway, I am Lou Frederick, representative from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I believe most of you have already heard me talk about this issue before. As you know, the data that I sought regarding the distribution of contracts under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act proved harder to obtain, and what we eventually got looked worse than we expected as of the first public hearing of this bill on February 22nd. Before we go any further, I want to clarify that what this bill does and what it does not do. Even though we now have some partial information about the distribution of state contracts, neither this bill nor the proposed amendment prescribes any remedy. We're simply looking to uncover some information that has proved more elusive than expected. Disaggregated data is the key to this. The more reported categories are aggregated, the less the data tells us. To recap, minority women and emerging small businesses are drastically underrepresented among businesses awarded contracts. Minority-owned businesses are drastically underrepresented among MWESB businesses awarded contracts. And in the data that we received, African-American and Asian businesses were left out entirely. What minimal participation was reported for minority contractors involved significantly smaller than average contracts. In addition, I was given a list of businesses in my district that had received state contracts. Turns out that a significant number merely have a mailbox there, and their physical locations are elsewhere. And I'll indulge in a brief editorial digression here. All parts of the economy are hurting, and keeping capable businesses in business is good for our recovery. Unfortunately, many minority communities have a shorter business history and consequently less capacity to absorb and weather the economic storm. The sparse data we have seen so far seem to indicate that minority businesses are not participating in recovery-focused programs at an economically meaningful level. We need to know more so that we can have a solid basis for studying why this might be and what might be done about it. The Dash 2 amendment represents collaboration with the governor's office to produce a more keenly focused bill. And again, this bill does not actually prescribe a remedy. This is a long-standing problem that will take some time to interpret and address. It does ask that this problem come out of the dark so that we can see it, study it, and figure out what to do about it. I ask for your support to schedule this bill for a work session and for your vote to send it to the House floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I would mention that you do have the Dash 2 amendment in your packets and on the Internet.
And you should have other information as well. That we sent over information about the bill and about some of the data that we have received.
Thank you very much. Not seeing any questions for your representative. I appreciate your diligence in staying after this one.
This is important to me.
And if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Certainly. Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, Acting Chair Holvey, Cheryl Myers, and members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Director of Economic and Business Equity in the Governor's Office, and I'm here today to express our support of House Bill 2958, including the Dash 2 Amendment.
Your name is?
I'm sorry, Cheryl Myers. As it provided resources to help support Oregon during the economic downturn, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act also set a new standard of transparency, accountability, and data reporting. However, over the course of the last 2 years, every state has monitored and reported how the Recovery Act funding was spent. While the data that was tracked provided valuable information regarding where resources were used, by whom, and for which projects, one data set that has not been collected to date is which Recovery Act recipients are registered as minority women or emerging small businesses. As the governor and the legislature continue to work to help grow Oregon's economy, we feel that continued mining of ERA data will allow us to better understand how firms that are registered as MWESB are accessing those opportunities, where firms are located, and other valuable information that we can use to improve our efforts and outcomes to reach and engage all of Oregon's business community. Recovery Act reporting provided us with a fairly comprehensive survey of how federal funding flows within our state, and we fully support the efforts to use that data proactively to gain as much information as possible about how to best use our resources. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony. Questions about this from the committee? Not seeing any questions at this point. I again appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it's a very important topic that we should be looking at. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2958 and reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3488. Colleagues, I neglected to mention that we have submitted testimony from Mike Eliason from Association of Oregon Counties on House Bill 3488. As well, this passed out information was presented to the House Committee on General Government, some charts about public contracts that was submitted in the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection, just for the record. With that, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3488. And
so, colleagues, we've got two other bills, HCR 36 and House Bill 3576, that we're planning to move very expeditiously. We'll begin, since Representative Buckley's here, open a public hearing on HCR 36.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. HCR 36 recognizes the achievements of the Ashland Talent and Medford Food Projects.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County, in fact, representing Ashland Town, even part of Medford, and legislature. Great resolution about our food project. I appreciate your consideration of it. If you pass it to the floor, you'll hear all about it on the floor when I present it.
Well done, Representative.
Yes.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Close the public hearing on HCR 36. Open a work session on HCR 36. Co-Chair Olson. HCR 36.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move that HCR 36 to the House floor with a do adopt.
Co-Chair Olson moves HCR 36 to the floor with a do adopt recommendations. Discussion. Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Garrett. Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask Representative Buckley to carry that on the floor, close the work session on HCR 36, and open a work session on House Bill 3576.
Mr. Chairman, you have House Bill 3576. You did adopt the -1 amendment on April 13th. This is for determining the required habitation within a district required for serving as state representative or senator. The -1 replaces the measure, directs elections officials to consider several factors in determining whether or not a candidate inhabits a district, including but not limited to where a person's mail is received, driver's license, motor vehicle registration, utility and tax return addresses, as well as voter registration. If any, you also have the -2 from Representative Wingard, which allows rather than directs the Secretary of State to consider a district in which the candidate is registered to vote. We do have revenue and fiscal information on the -1s.
Okay,
we are Mr. Chair.
Coach Olson.
I appreciate you taking some time out and allowing us to set this off, because a couple weeks ago, one of the things I had some concerns when Steve Trout came up and started kind of going through the -1s amendments, and initially I was supportive of where we were going with this for change, but then during his testimony, I had some issues. So that's when the following day, that Representative Holvey and I met with Gina and Steve Trout, and we really fleshed this whole thing out. I feel at this point right now, my concerns are relieved from it, and I'm supportive of the -1s.
Great. Thank you. We're on a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3576 as amended to
the -1. I was just informed we already adopted at our meeting on some date,
April 13th.
April 13th.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. You better double check though. Thank you. Keep going, Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I'll start over here. For clarity's sake, I move House Bill 3576 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 3576 as amended by the dash one amendments that we already incorporated to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I will say that I did appreciate the conversations that I had from everybody concerned on this issue, and I think it, although is a little bit confusing, is a good bill to move forward to provide some at least some direction for the Secretary of State to look at candidacy issues.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this forward, and thank you, Co-Chair Olson and Steve and Gina for hanging in there on this. Any further discussion? Amy, please call the roll. Excused.
Representative Derrick.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
No.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Motion carries. And Representative Holby, will you carry it on the floor?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Outstanding work session. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3576. And colleagues, I think I'm correct in saying that we are going to be meeting in Hearing Room E beginning on Monday.
Yes, this is our last meeting in Room 50.
Oh. Hey. Oh. Representative Berger is disappointed.
I demand an explanation.
It's closer to each of our offices. And it's more enjoyable atmosphere.
But I was getting good exercise out.
Mr. Chair, it probably reduces the efforts necessary to record this thing, too.
That may be. Colleagues, we're adjourned.